case of the morning, the United States versus Davis. Ms. Prasad, is it?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Vinayanka Prasad, and I'm appointed counsel representing today defendants Davis, Dilworth, Davison, Price, and Ciante Supp. Your Honors, the issue in this case really comes down to individualized treatment and meaningful consideration of ambiguities in a previous sentencing record. These defendants come before the court asking for a reduction in their previously imposed sentences. And the basis for that reduction is the retroactive application of amendments to the crack cocaine sentencing guidelines. The effect of those guidelines is to change the threshold quantity for the highest level of guideline punishment from 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine to 4.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. The effect of that is to triple the quantity for which a defendant must be held responsible in order to hold him to the highest level of responsibility.
You know, Ms. Prasad, I'm going to take you to an absolute bottom line question, I think, because what you seem to be arguing is that the court's acceptance of the PSR wasn't a sufficient means for the court to make its factual findings. But our case law, well, maybe I should just ask you, isn't our case law clear that it's permissible for a district court to discharge its obligation to make factual findings by adopting the contents and the analysis of the PSR?
Your Honor, I think that you are relying on the Broomfield case.
I'm relying on a lot of them, actually.
I think the Broomfield case is one case that specifically stated that a district court can rely on the PSR rather than making detailed factual findings on the record at the sentencing hearing. But in that case and in other cases of the Seventh Circuit, they do require that the district court rely only on reliable information, that it has scrutinized the information before it to ensure its reliability. The information that is contained in a PSR is first often allegations that are made against the defendant. There are objections to that information in the PSR, and then those objections are resolved.
Yes, but the district court made additional statements about each defendant's participation from which it later could infer the full scope of that defendant's involvement in the conspiracy. He either made factual findings in the original sentencing hearing or during the 3582 C hearing that each defendant was responsible for the full scope of the conspiracy.
Yes,
it's a pretty complete record, it seems to me.
Judge, I do think that actually does get to the heart of the issue, and that really makes clear sort of the circular pattern that we get into by relying on the PSR. The method by which the PSR has come to be the factual basis, the factual record, is that, again, first there were allegations, and then the court was presented with objections, and then it was asked to resolve those objections. But at the original sentencing hearing, the court did not fully resolve those objections in many of these cases. And the reason for that, and the court specifically stated on the record, especially in Aaron Davis's case, that is made very clear, that the court finds no reason to resolve those factual ambiguities because the threshold quantity that was relevant at the time was only 1.5 kilograms. The unambiguous facts before the court at that time allowed the court to make a finding of 1.5 kilograms.
Yeah, but you, of course, here we have, you know, a conspiracy that involved close to 17 kilograms of crack. And while it's true that initially the court didn't have to consider whether a defendant was responsible for 1.5 kilograms, there's, you know, no need to look further. When it was changed to 4.5, he still had that 17-kilogram conspiracy to deal with. I mean,
yes, Your Honor. The overall conspiracy was found. There were two separate conspiracies that were tried. One was found to have a quantity of 16.8 kilograms. The other was 19.8 kilograms. And that was the entire amount that the conspiracy could be found responsible for. But, of course, the case law is that each conspirator must be individually considered, and the scope of their agreement in an overall conspiracy must be individually considered. A conspirator is not automatically responsible for the entire scope of a conspiracy based on his entry into the conspiracy.
Well, and do you want to go through each one?
Yes.
I mean, if we talk about Davis, for instance, the court found that he continued to participate in the conspiracy even after he moved away. And in that case, the judge said even if he had the discretion, he would not have reduced the sentence. We go on to Mr. Scanty, was it?
Ciante.
Ciante. And there the court said that he could be responsible for the whole 16-point 9 kilograms, and alternatively that there was evidence to hold him responsible for the 4.5 without even relying on conspiracy activity. You know, you go on to Price, and so
yes, Your Honor, I could
you agree that your case is different with regard to every defendant. It's one of the awkwardnesses of consolidation, because it would seem to me that your worst case is Mr. Davis, whereas Judge Rovner pointed out Judge Moody made this alternate finding. He didn't make that with regard to all the other defendants, right?
Yes, Your Honor. There are very different factual bases for each one of these defendants.
Would you agree that your strongest case is with regard to Mr. Davison, who was, in fact, acquitted by the jury of conspiracy?
Actually, I do think Mr. Davis and Mr. Davison have very interesting issues that are very unique from the other defendants.
Okay. Well, Mr. Davis, going to Mr. Davis, isn't that exactly where Judge Moody made this alternate finding, where he said, even irregardless of any drug quantity determination, I would not use my discretion in terms of reducing this sentence and use the power given to me by the Sentencing Commission. Did he make that finding?
Yes, Your Honor.
And once he makes that finding, isn't that basically just subject to an abuse of discretion review?
No, Your Honor. I would argue that that is not correct. Based on the Mark Hall case, which is cited in the opening briefs, the Mark Hall case, actually, the judge found made the same finding, that in the alternative he would not use his discretion. Mm-hmm. However, the court found that his understanding of the drug quantity for which that defendant was responsible affected his decision to use his discretion. The same would be true in Mr. Davis's case. If Mr. Davis could not be held responsible for 16.8 kilograms of crack cocaine, that would have to have an effect on the judge's decision to use his discretion, especially where the judge has pointed out that one of the concerns that he had was uniformity in sentencing. If he had a defendant in front of him who was responsible for 16.8 kilograms, of course the uniformity consideration would be very different.
But in the original sentencing, as I recall, the judge said that Mr. Davis, that it was more likely than not that he was involved in 19.8 kilograms of crack.
Your Honor, I do think that that statement is what the court has ultimately basically relied on to support its finding mm-hmm. that this defendant is responsible for the entire amount.
And
no,
isn't
he
that
also added...
Okay, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge. Well, he also added that he was still involved in the conspiracy even after he moved away. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much do you want from a district judge?
Well, Your Honor, I think...
Keeping in mind that there's one here today.
two formers.
Plenty of former district court judges on this panel.
Percent.
Here's my question. Going to uniformity, and I know you didn't answer this, but I just want to point this out to you. There's another Hall case. That's United States versus Dwayne Hall, the same drug gang, this Concord gang. Judge Sykes issued that opinion. Didn't she already affirm a similar finding by Judge Moody, again, extrapolating from the 16.9 determination that he made by a preponderance of the evidence? Why shouldn't that control?
Well, again, Your Honor, as Your Honor has pointed out, each defendant is very factually distinct. Mm-hmm. Dwayne Hall, of course, had a very different set of factual bases. Mm-hmm. Dwayne Hall pled guilty mm-hmm. to the counts against him. These defendants chose to go to trial. There were a number of issues that remained unresolved at the end of their sentencing hearings. Dwayne Hall did not raise the same objections to the PSR that were raised by these defendants, mm-hmm. and therefore these defendants need to have further scrutiny. Going to Judge Rovner's question, I do believe, Judge, that the district court did not actually make the finding that this defendant continued to be a part of the conspiracy until the resentencing hearing. At the time of the original sentencing, he found no reason to determine whether or not the evidence that could link Mr. Davis to the conspiracy after he had moved in 1998. He had no reason to determine whether that was credible and accurate evidence. Now he goes, now we are able to go back and look at the PSR, and that's the information in front of us. But the PSR does not talk about the inaccuracies in the evidence, the questionable credibility of any of that evidence. The PSR does not attempt to resolve those issues. Those were remaining outstanding issues. The district court does not, upon resentencing, go back and scrutinize that evidence and ask whether that evidence is accurate and credible. And that is what is necessary to ensure that the mm-hmm. tripling of quantity of drugs is actually based in credible and reliable evidence, as is required by this court.
In the case of Mr. Davidson, didn't Judge Moody disagree with the PSR? Didn't the PSR make a finding that what was reasonably foreseeable was a quantity of drugs less than 4.5 kilograms?
Yes. In the case of Mr. Davidson, the PSR, the second PSR upon mm-hmm. resentencing actually did recommend that Mr. Davidson should receive a reduction because mm-hmm. he was not found guilty of the conspiracy offense, mm-hmm. and he could only be held responsible for the 1.5 kilograms that the court originally found him guilty of.
And do you think the record that Judge Moody made at resentencing would bear out a drug quantity finding more than 4.5 kilograms of crack cocaine?
No, Your Honor, and I think that there are some actually some detailed numbers that we could look at, which the main number that the court had in front of it was that Mr. Davidson was responsible for selling about 28 grams of cocaine a week. At that level, he would have to have sold for 13 years at that same level to mm-hmm. have reached the quantity of 4.5 kilograms of mm-hmm. crack cocaine. The court, however, sort of generically, states that he has been a part of a joint conspiracy. He does not say that he was part of a conspiracy. He says that he has entered into a joint activity, and that based on that joint activity, he would have knowledge of the remaining quantity that other individuals were selling.
Well, he also noted that Mr. Davidson was an accomplice to murders carried out in furtherance of the conspiracy.
And that was another issue that was objected to at the original sentencing hearing, which, of course, the judge, that was not a part of the sentence. It was not something that the judge had to rely on to determine the ultimate sentence. It wasn't an enhancement included in the PSR's finding of the guideline. It was not actually a part.
How do you know this?
Well,
I mean, here's the judge saying, you know, you're an accomplice to murders that were committed in a conspiracy, and you're saying that the judge didn't consider this?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. What I am attempting to say is that it isn't a part of the ultimate guideline. It isn't a part. It isn't entered into the calculation that is done to determine what the guideline range is. And the guideline range at that time, of course, was a binding range, and the court sentenced a defendant within the guideline range. That was not any particular enhancement under the guidelines was not granted for that activity. And, of course, that activity was objected to. If this court has no further questions, I would like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Kirchhoff?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Emily Kirchhoff on behalf of the United States. First, I would like to go back and respond to a couple of the arguments that the defense counsel has made. There has been discussion about whether or not some of these drug quantity issues were resolved at the original sentencing. And while the focus there was on the 1.5 kilograms and if the defendant was responsible for or, you know, that amount of drugs was reasonably foreseeable to that defendant, the district court explicitly adapted the PSR as to the base offense level for each of the defendants in this conspiracy. And insofar as that only relied on 1.5 kilograms, this court has said in U.S. v. Duane Hall that the district court, in resolving the 3582C, can go back and make additional fact findings to clarify that, in fact, the drug quantity is more than 4.5 kilograms at this point. The district court in this case sat through two trials with multiple defendants through the sentencing hearings of all of these defendants and did address the objections raised by each of the defendants at their sentencing hearings, yet rejected their challenges and found that each defendant could be held responsible for in excess of 1.5 kilograms at the time of the original sentencing and in excess of 4.5 kilograms through the 3582C process.
But the reduction orders were all entered without any type of hearing.
They were, yes. And the same procedure was undertaken in U.S. v. Duane Hall. Mm-hmm. And the defendants have not, in their original 3582C motions, did they present or proffer what type of evidence they would present to refute the PSR, nor have they presented any type of evidence on appeal.
They just filed motions for reductions.
Correct.
That were summarily denied.
Exactly. And the argument
I shouldn't
was,
say summarily, but there was an order that Judge Moody gave his reasons for denying.
Correct. And he went back and reviewed the addendums to the PSRs, the original PSRs.
What's your position with regard to Judge Moody not adopting the PSR addendum with regard to Mr. Davidson?
There is his resentencing or his order in denying the 3582C motion explains why he didn't. And he explicitly lays out that Mr. Davidson was involved in just a seven-month period with four other individuals, taking turns selling crack cocaine on the Hill. And in this seven-month period, testimony established that those five individuals were responsible for selling over 3.5 kilograms of crack cocaine. And so relying on that testimony, as well as the fact that Mr. Davidson that the court had found at the original sentencing hearing that Mr. Davidson was a part of the conspiracy, that it was reasonably foreseeable to him that over a five-year span, the conspiracy would distribute more than 4.5 kilograms.
So in making the conspiracy determination, the district court judge discounted the jury's verdict.
And he said in the original sentencing transcript, I believe, that there are different burdens of proof. And while the jury may have acquitted Mr. Davidson based on proof beyond reasonable doubt, he found, for sentencing purposes, that the evidence showed by a preponderance that Mr. Davidson was, in fact, involved in this conspiracy. Mr. Davidson's argument about the fact that it would have taken him 13 years to distribute enough only looks at his personal sales. And as is well established, conspiracy law allows for a defendant to be held responsible not only for his direct distribution, but also what was reasonably foreseeable to him. And the district court's order emphasizes what it was reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Davison. He was a member for at least 5 years, took turns with others, so he knew that he was not the only one distributing, knew that his co-conspirators were receiving large amounts of crack cocaine from the higher-ups in the conspiracy as well.
Could I ask you where we could see the letter that was written to Davis in 2001 that formed part of the basis for concluding that he was part of the conspiracy until 2001? It was referenced on page 4 of Davis' brief.
I at this time do not know where we can find that letter. I would be more than happy to look for it and submit it to the court through a 28J letter if
That'd
you would like. Okay.
What do you make of the fact that the district court judge made a point in Mr. Davis's case to say that even but for the drug quantity determination I'm making, I would not exercise my discretion to reduce his sentence, but no such language appears with regard to all of the other defendants?
I believe that his decision to make that alternative finding mm-hmm. in Mr. Davis's case does make show, you know, he did exercise his discretion in deciding that even if he was eligible, he would not. So that gives this court can provide even more deference to his decision because he did exercise his discretion. As to why he made that in regards to Aaron Davis and not the others, I would only be speculating as to why. There was some time lapse between when the district court denied Mr. Davis's motion as to when he denied the motions of others. I did not look to see if there was case law in between the two that kind of clarified what needed to be done that allowed Judge Moody to decide that he didn't need to make that alternative finding. If there are no other questions in response to either specific defendants or in general, the government would respectfully request that the district court's denial of the motions be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Cook.
Thank you.
Ms. Prasad?
Your Honors, I believe I am almost out of time, so I would like to summarize my response, and that is that we have to look at the scope of any individual agreement. And in this case, a generic reliance on an individual joining a conspiracy does not resolve the individual ambiguities that are within their PSR. And this court has held time and time again that the government must prove a certain drug quantity at the original sentencing, and that is its burden to establish the reliability of its own evidence. If the court did not assess the reliability and scrutinize the reliability of that evidence in the initial sentencing hearing, we cannot now transform that evidence into fully reliable bases for denying a resentencing. Thank you, Your Honors, and if there are no further questions, I would respectfully ask that this court reverse the district court. Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.